Prologue. The Kissinger Grunt. December 2, 1975. At 2 p.m., there was to be a meeting of the Interagency Working Group on the third floor, C Corridor, of the Central Intelligence Agency at Langley, Virginia. The civil war in Angola was going badly for our allies, and the CIA had formally recommended a major escalation, the introduction of American military advisors, to the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. The working group, a subsidiary of the 40 Committee, itself a subsidiary of the National Security Council, was meeting to hear Henry Kissinger's decision. These meetings, which were happening every week or so, required a lot of preparation. I had been at it since 7 a.m., conferring with my boss, Jim Potts, the Africa Division Chief, drafting cables to the field, slipping in and out of meetings with logistics officers, paramilitary officers, communications and reports personnel. Lunch was a 75-cent sandwich, dispensed from a machine and eaten hastily between phone calls. At 1:45, I hurried down to the Angola Operations Center, where the 4-by-5-foot map of Angola was propped against a wall, and took notes as Pat, my intelligence assistant, briefed me on the current tactical situation inside Angola. She had the information from the SOG Situation Room across the building. Footnote. SOG, S-O-G. Special Operations Group, the agency's paramilitary office. It would have been more efficient for the SOG officer to brief me personally, but he held a grudge. I had reprimanded him in Vietnam for being drunk when we were attempting to evacuate our upcountry post during a lull in the fighting. In our small world, we preferred having Pat between us. At 1:55, I hurried back to my office to gather my notes for the briefing I would give the working group, and to glance at last-minute cables. Pat and a secretary took the map down to the conference room on C Corridor. Another assistant dropped off stacks of photocopied briefing papers and hurried downstairs to meet the working group members as they arrived from the White House, State Department, and Pentagon. All visitors, even senior ambassadors and top advisors from the White House, were given visitors' badges and escorted every moment they were inside CIA headquarters. I overtook Jim Potts, who was moving with slow dignity on a cane, his balance more precarious than when he used his crutches. Once a college football star, Potts had been struck down by polio in middle age. I ducked past him into the conference room to make sure everything was ready. The others filed in, exchanging amenities. The State Department officers in their traditional dark gray vested suits. The Lieutenant General from Defense in his Air Force uniform. The Admiral wearing an inexpensive business suit. A colonel, sporting a double-knit jacket and bright red slacks. There were 11 of us in the room. Each received a copy of the memos and reports we would discuss. Potts nodded, and I stood facing the group. Using a pointer, I started at the top of the map and talked my way down through the battlefields, bringing everyone up to date since the previous week's meeting. In the north, our allies, the FNLA, and the elite Zairean para-commando battalions had been routed and were now a broken rabble. Kinshasa Station had reported that the FNLA headquarters at Ambriz, on the coast north of the capital, was in a, quote, stable state of panic, unquote. Only in the south were we holding on. The South African armored column had not yet met its match in the gathering Cuban army, but we knew it was only a matter of time before the much larger and better equipped Cuban force became irresistible. 2 weeks earlier, on November 14th, frustrated by reverses on the battlefield, the 40 Committee had asked the CIA to outline a program which could win the Angolan War. As an interim measure, it had recommended the expenditure of the last $7 million in the CIA Contingency Reserve Fund, bringing the Angola program's budget to $31.7 million. On November 24th, the CIA had presented the 40 Committee with optional plans, costing an additional $30, $60, or $100 million. But with the agency's reserves expended, there were no more secret funds. Without authority to approve the larger amounts of money, and unwilling to order an end to the CIA covert action program, the 40 Committee was frustrated. In honored bureaucratic fashion, it adjourned, requesting another agency recommendation, one that would outline a bare-bones proposal for keeping the conflict alive. Today's meeting concerned that paper. It recommended not only the introduction of American advisors into the Angolan battlefields, but also more sophisticated and powerful weapons, The working group had endorsed the paper, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Ed Mulcahy, had taken it to Secretary Kissinger. Kissinger was, as always, preoccupied with other matters of state and his rather complicated social life. Ambassador Mulcahy had had difficulty gaining an audience, but had finally succeeded. We would soon know with what result. At the outset of the program, Potts had confided a desire to make the working group sessions so dull that non-CIA members would be discouraged in their supervision of our war. He had succeeded brilliantly. Working his way laboriously down a long agenda, he generally took 3 hours to cover 1 hour's material. While his listeners struggled with fatigue, boredom, and the labor of digesting lunch in the poorly ventilated conference room. Inevitably, breathing grew heavier. Heads would nod, bounce up, then nod again. I myself never dared to sleep, a colonel in a room full of general officers. Footnote. In the agency's personnel system, supergrades, GS-16s and above, compare to general officers in the military. I was a GS-14. Today, at least, there ought to be enough interest to keep them awake for a while. After all, we were meeting to plan a major escalation of a war. I finished my presentation and sat down. Potts turned to Mulcahy and spoke pleasantly. Well, Ed, what did Kissinger say? Mulcahy tamped his pipe and sucked on it for a few moments, apparently having trouble framing an answer. Potts watched him quietly. Finally, Mulcahy spoke. He didn't exactly say anything. Did he read the paper? Oh, yes. I took it to him myself just a few minutes before he left for Peking. I insisted he read it. You mean he didn't make any comment? He just read it and took off. Potts looked baffled, exasperated. Mulcahy nodded ruefully. He read it. Then he grunted and walked out of his office. Grunted? Yeah, like, hmm. Mulcahy grunted. He's going to be gone 10 days, Potts scowled. What are we supposed to do in Angola in the meantime? We have to make some decisions today. Mulcahy shrugged helplessly. They looked at each other. Well, was it a positive grunt or a negative grunt? Potts asked. Mulcahy studied for a moment, considering. It was just a grunt, like, hmm. I mean, it didn't go up or down. This group of somber men were supervising the country's only current war. They were gathered today to discuss steps that could affect world peace. No one was smiling. Mulcahy grunted again, emphasizing a flat sound. Down the table, someone else tried it, experimenting with the sound of a positive grunt, then a negative one, his voice rising, then falling. Others attempted it while Potts and Mulcahy watched. Well, Potts said, do we proceed with the advisors? Mulcahy scowled and puffed on his pipe, uncomfortable in his position as Kissinger's surrogate. We better not, he said finally. Kissinger just decided not to send Americans into the Sinai. Everyone nodded in agreement. Inaction was safe and easier to correct. The meeting proceeded, and I watched, taking notes and pondering. I had been involved since the outset as the chief of the Angola Task Force. I had considerable knowledge of the war, and by the time Kissinger grunted, considerable doubts. This book is about those two things, the knowledge and the doubts.